Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of the Big Red Bus. I'm here with the great one, Doug Tonis, and we're excited as we pull it out. It's shiny and red. Another exciting week for the beloved Bull. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing great. I've said that I need to start picking up a more negative attitude just to counterbalance you because you're just too fun and too happy right now.
Well, what's not to love after that dominating victory over a tough, scrappy Atlanta Hawks team yesterday? What'd you think of that performance?
I thought that game was extremely difficult to watch. It was funny. We were up by like 15 at one point, and I'm like, we're playing terrible. We're playing terrible, and we're up by like 15 points. Yeah. Atlanta definitely is completely thrown in the towel, or is maybe just without talent overall, but it was not a fun game to watch, even though it was a fairly straightforward Bulls victory.
Amen, but I'd like to start out with your thoughts on Markkanen, because I thought Markkanen in the beginning of that game, he was extremely effective without hitting the three. He was 0-for-4 on the night from three-point range. And I don't know if you feel this way, but I was pretty excited with what I saw in Q1. And basically, I have this theory on the three, the power of the three. It's a soul-crushing shot. I mean, we've seen it with you, Doug. Doug, for and all the listeners here, Doug is one of the best three-point shooters you'll ever see in a pickup game. He's a fantastic shooter. And I don't know how many times we've played a game, and Doug's hit about four or five threes. And you could just see the life just drain out of the opposition. It's such a soul-crushing, floor-spreading shot. But what I think you really exponentially increase the power of that shot when it's a big with post skills who's able to hit that three. Post skills and quickness. And in the early part of the game, you saw the Bulls run some very smart plays for Markkanen, I felt, where he was positioned out at the three-point line, and then he quickly sprinted towards the basket off a pick from Holiday. Holiday set some really nice picks early in that game, as Stephen Ngo on his Twitter feed highlighted. And then you saw him just get these easy dunks. I think a guy who can hit the three it quickly can become unguardable if he has those post skills also. What did you feel about Markkanen's performance yesterday? And what do you agree or disagree with my assertions?
I can't really say a whole lot about it, to be honest with you. I'm a little less impressed with Lowry this week than maybe past weeks. Still a fantastic prospect, and not to say anything about his ceiling or overall play or anything like that. But, you know, he wasn't super effective against Golden State in the game that you felt he could be really effective, and in a game you really needed him. He was pretty effective, and I do think it's a good point. He was effective without hitting the three against Atlanta. But then at the same time, I don't know how excited I was about that, because Atlanta's interior defense was terrible. I mean, look what Robin Lopez did against Atlanta. I mean, it was just they really had nothing in the post defensively. I would say overall that I think the slashing skills and the quickness off the first step is far more important to complement the three-point shooter than post-up skills. I don't know how much, you know, being able to post up helps you if you're also a three-point shooter. It does add a nice wrinkle in that it's difficult to find a guy who's going to be able to guard Lowry in the post and then also guard him on the perimeter. You know, it's tough to find those types of matchups. But I think in some ways that's probably easier to find now than maybe it was, say, 5 years ago, just because there are more of these guys who are taller, quicker, and shooting. And, you know, Lowry is not like a dominating physical presence. He's not Shaq in the post or anything like that. So, you know, if you took another guy like Lowry, and I think you're going to have a league that's filled with guys that are sort of similar, maybe not as good, but there's a lot more guys coming out who are sort of similar to this. There's a bunch of them in this draft that maybe project out to be guys who are, you know, rangy big men. And so you're going to see more guys who are, you do have the size and do have the range. They're used to being able to do that. So it's a nice thing. I think the Bulls maybe with Lowry are a little bit ahead of the curve, but I do think we're going to see more guys like this coming into the NBA. Certainly, even big men are now being trained that you have to be able to shoot. You have to have this perimeter-oriented game now at lower levels of basketball, which wasn't really the case, say, 10 years ago.
No doubt. You've even seen it with guys who are bigs in the league already, that they're improving from year over year in their three-point skills. A perfect example is Towns, who this year is shooting at a plus 40, which is insane for a player whose basically his entire career has been just in the post and is known as one of the best post players in the NBA. For him to develop that skill, it really almost makes you, I think, unguardable. But the issue with Towns to me is when I watch Towns, he's hitting at a great rate, and maybe he will cause more attention brought out to him. But Markkanen has more gravity. When I mean that is that they guard him more aggressively at the three-point line. I think teams prefer if Towns is – is out there sometimes as opposed to in the post. And it just wrecks your defense. It's just a horrible thing to happen, to have, where you have a guy who draws that much attention, who's a big, who can quickly get that down low. To me, the whole goal is, what is a guy like that going to do? He's going to cause you to draw double teams. And any contender, general rule I have of life, if you do not have a guy who can draw a double team on your team, you're not a contender. You have to have at least one, and the best teams have multiple guys like that. I think Markkanen at 20 is showing that once that three-point shot starts getting hit with more consistency, I don't think he's living up to his potential yet there. I think he's going to draw a double team almost on every night. And the Bulls have had a lot of guys that fans have loved who have rarely, if ever, drawn double teams. I can go through a whole list, Heinrich, Deng. I'm not going to give you the full list for starting a massive debate here, but you need to have those guys on the team. Do you foresee him to being that guy on a night-to-night basis that's going to draw a double?
Of course. He definitely looks like he's trending in that direction. The one thing I'll say is right now, I don't think Lowry is the guy who creates his own shot a whole lot. If I looked in, I was going to compare, say, Lowry to Nico. Nico, to me, is a more deadly offensive player playing at the level he is at this moment, whereas three-point shot is a lot of times coming off the dribble. You know, he's shooting from a little bit further away. He's shooting with guys in his face. Now, Lowry's threes are mostly coming from kickouts, and he's also hitting a much lower percentage. A lot of his threes are wide-open threes. His thing that's impressed me more about him than actually his three-point shooting, which I think is off to a nice start, but I think it will get better. I agree with you. He has not hit his three-point potential, and we often see that in the NBA for rookies. When you have to move back to the slightly further line than the college line, it takes guys a year or two to adjust the range at extra, you know, 8 or 9 inches, whatever it is. And so I expect Lowry to get better, for sure. But what I am more impressed with is his ability in the post. But I do think he has a ways to go still in creating his own shot. And that's really what you want, in addition to drawing double teams. Like, if you just get him in the post, yeah, maybe he's double teamed. But I don't see him yet as getting double teamed on the perimeter. And I think that is where things get really dangerous when you're an offensive player who draws a double team 25 feet away from the basket. You know, at that point, you know, you have a lot of open passing lanes. You have less guys at the basket. You have a lot you can do. And I do think Lowry can become that type of guy, but I don't think he is there yet. And I think it'll take a couple of years.
Great. Let's go on to Dunn with this such an unfortunate incident in the Golden State game. I mean, I think quietly he was second in the league in steals and very limited MPGs compared to the other guys in the top 10. I just felt he has become one of the better perimeter defensive guards in the league. He was just on the defensive end. Every night there's something he does that impresses the heck out of me. And then you see a play like that where he's basically got a breakaway, and it's just so unfortunate. He holds onto the rim a little bit too long and lands up on his face. Now he's out probably 3 weeks. He's in concussion protocol. First of all, your thoughts on how Chris Dunn was progressing. I know we talked a little bit about it last week, but just let's kind of focus on specifically the defensive end. And is this really going to set him back to the point that, you know, oh my gosh, get your thoughts in general, how you think he's going to come back from this.
So I think it's a nothing injury in terms of his long-term development. Obviously, it was really painful. Obviously, it was terrible. It's very grateful it wasn't worse. I mean, when you saw the angle he landed at, your first thought is like he could have paralyzed himself. Like, his head and body were at an angle that did not look healthy for his neck at all. Mm-hmm. So thank God it was not worse. Concussion is certainly bad. You know, we've seen all the news from the NFL where you can get all kinds of permanent problems, but you're not really getting repeatedly hit in the head in the NBA, so it's unlikely that that's going to be an issue for Chris Dunn, you know, when he's like 60 or 70. I do think, obviously, it wasn't a fun injury by any stretch, but I think in 3 weeks it's not going to matter. I think he's going to be on the court whenever he's out of the concussion protocol, whenever that is. I think he's going to be on the court. It'll take him maybe one or two games to get his wind back, because while you're in the concussion protocol, you can't really, you know, hit your cardio super hard because your head starts swimming and everything. So I do think it'll take him a little time to adjust, but it's like maybe one or two games after he misses, say, six or seven games and comes back. And then I think he'll be the same player. Now, if we could talk about Chris Dunn overall, I think steals, it's great that he's getting steals, but I think steals is an overrated aspect of defense. I do think sometimes Dunn is not as fundamentally strong as he should be. He's a high-risk, high-reward defensive type of player. You know, maybe kind of reminds me a lot of Rondo defensively, in that sometimes he gambles a lot and then he gets a lot of steals doing that, and he can be very disruptive doing that. But sometimes he's getting beat fundamentally a lot too. And I think in that Golden State game prior to him going out, you know, he was really getting torched a little bit at times defensively. But then, you know, David Labo, I thought, was doing a much better job defensively. He's also, you know, very aggressive, but is a little bit more fundamentally strong. I still like Chris Dunn's defense, but I think he has some rough edges. I think really his whole game is like that. He has some rough edges that he really needs to smooth out. And whether he can smooth those out will be the difference between, is he a good player, which I think we've seen already, he's going to be a good player, or is he going to be a great player? Yeah. And that's going to take us a couple of years to find out, probably.
You know, great comments there. LaVine had two bad games in a row. He was 2-9 shooting yesterday. I thought he had a really rough game against Golden State. But, you know, he played fantastic, I felt, in the other two games, his first two games back, especially against the Heat. What have you seen from him so far this week? Just like to get your just general comments on LaVine and how you felt he started out so far for the Beloved.
Yeah, I think, like, offensively, LaVine looks like he's going to do everything you want him to do. Even the last two games where he didn't shoot well, you know, the types of shots he feels comfortable making, taking, and even though he wasn't making them all, he looks good. He looks smooth offensively. The ball coming out of his hand looked crisp. It looked like it was a shot that had a good chance to go in. You know, it didn't look like, you know, the arc was good. Like, everything kind of looked good the way he was playing for the most part. I was pretty excited about the athleticism he was using, his commitment to trying to get to the basket. I thought he made a few nice passes here and there. Overall, I think his game offensively is fine. You know, I think he'll improve and get a little bit more consistent just as he gets those minutes up and gets to play more and gets used to his teammates and stuff like that. That'll be fine. Defensively, I mean, Zach LaVine lost that Golden State game for us. I mean, just flat out. Mm-hmm. Just flat out lost the game. I mean, ignoring the 2-for-9, there was the run where Klay Thompson hit three straight three-pointers. Zach LaVine was supposed to be guarding him. Klay Thompson was, like, by himself for three in a row. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know how you can possibly give Klay Thompson three three-point shots, like, with no one near him. Like, I mean, there was that gif going around Twitter where Zach LaVine was spinning around in circles trying to figure out who he was supposed to guard. I don't know if you saw that one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he really looks lost off the ball. I think, actually, once he gets on the ball, his defense isn't so bad. But it's just he really doesn't seem to know where to stand a lot of times when his guy doesn't have the ball. And I think he's a guy teams are going to abuse defensively. He's still a young player that needs to be coached out of him. But it's been now, this is his fourth season, so it's been a while for him to still be playing like a rookie defensively. You know, he really plays like he has no idea what he's supposed to do defensively. What is your take on that?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I always feel, I think with your comments there where he's on the ball, I don't think he's too bad. He's got all the skills to be a great defender. I kind of noticed when he was, out there, I felt like on the ball, I thought, I kept on saying to myself, there's no reason this guy with a little bit of want to can't be at least adequate. But you're right. But for some players, it does take longer to kind of catch that part of the game. Big picture, he's only 22. I keep on saying that, you know, he'll learn these things, he'll learn these skills. But he did have 1 year under Tom, who's a, you know, allegedly the defensive guru. And he's I will admit it is troublesome to see a performance like that in Q3 against Golden State, because I mean, that's the reason we lost. You're absolutely right there. That third quarter was awful, and he had a big part of it. I still kind of feel when the game's on the line, and these games that really matter, he's got enough athletic ability to hopefully compensate for his sometimes mistakes on that end. And in general, I always feel like as long as we get a big that's ultra good defensively, that will cover up a lot of mistakes on the perimeter. But that kind of makes it even more imperative that we get a Clint Capella type of big to help close out games where we really need somebody to help clean up the mess that sometimes may occur on the outside. I just feel like Dunn, the pairing of those two will kind of help, because you can always put Dunn. To me, like, you know, Dunn, Golden State, obviously you couldn't do that since they have so much talent in the backcourt, but I kind of feel like Dunn could easily just slide over and guard any two in this league and be able to shut that guy down if we have LaVine really having a rough time. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I kind of agree with what you're saying there. Golden State is such a unique matchup because they have Klay, they have Curry, they have Durant. You know, no other team is bringing three guys like that offensively that you have to guard in the perimeter. You know, usually you can hide one weak perimeter defender on someone. And we saw that in other games, right? Like, so Dunn's defense was similarly bad in all four games, in my opinion. But it was only the Golden State game where it was really exposed and torched. Like, the other teams didn't have someone to really take at him to make it a big thing. So I don't know how much of weakness is. I tend to agree that your interior defenders are more important. I do think that might not be as true in today's NBA as it was, you know, 5-10 years ago, just because you see so much three-point shooting. Like, if we had an amazing front-court defensive player, you know, Klay Thompson was still going to hit all those threes on Zach LaVine.
No doubt.
You know, it wasn't going to help with that. So there is probably more importance around perimeter defense now than there was, you know, 5-6 years ago, because teams have shifted so much towards relying on the three-point shot as a major weapon in the game.
It is frustrating, though. I will add this, is that I did notice while watching that game, Klay Thompson and Zach LaVine is physically look so similar, height and weight-wise. I don't know if you felt that way. I kind of love watching them out there. I'm like, God, these guys have to be the exact same height and the exact same weight. And then one guy is still, in Klay Thompson, so much better on the defensive end. He's significantly
better.
It's
not a matter of size or athleticism or anything like that. It's a matter of, I think, mental awareness. I don't even think it's really a matter of effort. I mean, I don't think, like, Zach is lazy, really. I just think it's just a matter of, like, mental awareness. He mentally does not seem to know where he should be. When you watch him playing off the ball, he's frequently guarding sort of like the corner three, and then he's on the weak side, so he's kind of like leaning in towards the paint. Mm-hmm. You know, he's often like nowhere near close enough to the baseline. He's like floating like too far towards the perimeter, so he can't recover on the guy who's in the corner, and also he's not in really good position to try and, you know, rotate in to cut someone off on the inside. If a big man goes down there, he's just like always standing in not quite the right spot. And it's just like two steps from where he really needs to be standing. And he often just loses his guy. If his guy like makes a move out of that rotation and makes a cut, he's not paying close enough attention. He doesn't have his head on a swivel to really watch what's going on enough. It just seems like mentally he doesn't seem to have an awareness of what his responsibilities are and what he should be doing. And so you hope that's the type of thing that can be coached out of him, because I do agree he has all the physical tools he needs to be really not even an adequate defender, but to be an excellent defender. I mean, to be an outstanding defender. He's a guy who could be an outstanding defender. So hopefully he can make some of those adjustments over time. Hopefully he gets the right type of coaching. Hopefully that's drilled into him. The fact that he did work under Thibodeau for a while and that still hasn't happened, and we know how Tom would preach those types of things, does make me a little nervous about it happening. But you're right. I agree with you. He's still so young. It's not a lost cause by any stretch. You know, LeBron James was a terrible defender at one point in his career. He's an amazing defender now. So these guys can make those types of changes. And when they're young, they're frequently very poor at this.
Yeah, amen. Let's talk a little bit about an interesting article and then also an interview with Brian Windhorst this past week. I heard it on ESPN, Waddle and Sylvie. He was on, I think, on Thursday, and he basically went over the points he made in the article, which is the Bulls are, it's actively known across the NBA, the Bulls are willing to take on salary, but if they're going to take on that salary, it's going to cost a heavy penalty. Like to get, if you had a chance to read that article, and in general, do you think that's the better decision than keeping the cap flexibility and maybe trying to sign a free agent this summer, or keeping the cap flexibility going into the following summer?
So there's a few scenarios, right, that you can take on salary. There's one that two teams want to make a trade, but there's not a salary match for some reason, and they need to shift you an expiring deal for this year because they can't quite match the trade financially. In that scenario, the Bulls should just jump all over it, just be all over it, because there's no harm, right? You still get all your cap room back. You're not going to do anything with it in the next 3 months anyway. So you should be all over it, buy whatever picks you can. That's the no-brainer scenario, and if the Bulls have that opportunity, they should take it. Mm-hmm. The second scenario, then, is where you take back a multi-year deal and you lose your cap room this summer in order to get some kind of compensation. And that becomes a trickier scenario because, one, if you take on salary right now, say you take on $10 million this year, and you do it at the deadline, and I don't know, say 50 games are played, you're not only paying the guy 3/8 of that $10 million, so you're paying him whatever, like 3.75 million, whatever 3/8 of 10 million is. You're paying him that much money, and then so the cost to you isn't that expensive to get that pick, and he's gone afterwards. But once you take a multi-year deal, say you take on Luol Deng with 2 years left after this year, now you're paying him, you know, like, what is it, $36 million over the next 2 years after this year, plus another, you know, like $8 million this year. So now you're really taking on like $44 million of salary commitment and a guy who has no value to you on the court. So you're basically paying out a huge amount of money. So what is $44 million to you worth in terms of draft picks? You know, that ought to buy you something really, really amazing.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to put in $44 million. I mean, it used to be that you could buy a first-round draft pick in the 20s for around $3 or $4 million. We'll say the NBA salary cap is not quite double, but gone up maybe 40, 50%. So say it should cost you $6 or $7 million now. So if you start looking at taking on guys like Joakim Noah or Luol Deng or some of these other guys who have big contracts, you're now realistically looking at taking on like $40, $50 million. You better get something really good. That said, I would much prefer the Bulls to do that than to keep their cap room open and use it this summer.
And is that the reason because you're not a big fan of the free agent list for this upcoming summer, or is it just the position the Bulls are in now in the early stages of a rebuild?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, I don't think you're going to get the marquee guys to come here, and unless you get LeBron James, the marquee guys really aren't that good. Chris Paul is another marquee guy who probably won't leave Houston, but even if he does come here, like, we don't need Chris Paul, right? He doesn't have a long enough tenure left in his career where the Bulls are going to be able to make their mark with him right away. So it would be a very poor pickup for Chicago in terms of how much they'd have to pay him versus what they could realistically do with him on the court. And Paul knows that, so he's not going to come in either. Same with LeBron James. I mean, I would take LeBron, obviously, or Paul, really, but they're not going to come here. And then, so now the next best guys are DeMarcus Cousins and Paul George. I don't think Paul George is going to come here for the same reason. So I do think it's interesting that they don't really have good choices. I broke down all the teams with the salary cap. I unfortunately forgot to save the document, but there's no one who's any good that has cap room. There's really no one, and there's not really a list of teams that can do two max contracts. Even L.A., where they said maybe they can get two, it's going to be very tricky for them to do that if they can't figure out a way to unload Luol Deng or Clarkson. So we'll see how that goes for them. But I do think it's going to be one of those things where there's not really great free agents. There's not a lot of money out there either. I think the Bulls are going to have a lot of extensions coming up. I don't think they want to lock in, you know, any of these sort of like subpar free agents at a high premium and then run into cap problems 2 years down the line when all these other guys they have who are young need extensions. So I think they're better off if they can use this room to take on some salary this year. That salary then rolls off the books in a few years when they have to lock in all these guys and they get some extra draft picks that can help them. I think that would be my plan. The problem is you just have to hope there's a team that's really willing to sell draft picks. And in today's NBA, that seems to be more and more rare.
Mm-hmm. What about, is this situation possible? Is this even possible where the Lakers, let's say we get to the right before the free agency period, and the Cavs are obviously having some problems now. They had another blowout loss yesterday to the Thunder. Things are looking bad. And I know everyone says, well, the Cavs, they do this every year. Not quite to this level. This has been something that's a little bit different with how many points they've been giving up and how bad it's been in the last, you know, couple weeks. But let's just assume the Cavs do flame out this year and they don't even get out of the East and LeBron decides to pack up his bags and go elsewhere. And he sees an opportunity with the Lakers, and the Lakers obviously can't do what he wants unless they get rid of that dang contract. So finally, with enough convincing, they're willing to give up Brandon Ingram, let's say, an asset like that. I don't think they have their draft pick this year. Is that something that they could do the day before free agency starts, or is there kind of a time limit on a move like that, where the Lakers would be able to send us a Brandon Ingram and Deng for assets like the day before free agency starts?
They could do that at any point, right? They could do that after free agency starts or before. I mean, there's no real timing involved. Because they just need to get under the cap when free agency is around. So they don't have an urgency to it. They can negotiate with LeBron, and they can say, hey, LeBron, this is what we're going to do. Will you come here under these circumstances? You know, and then see. And if LeBron says yes, then they make the move. You know, they have to obviously have the move lined up.
Yeah, but that's...
If so, they can execute it before or after free agency. And clearly they're not going to execute it before free agency, right? If you're the Lakers, you're not going to give up Ingram and then hope that LeBron comes. I mean, you have to first get a commitment and then say, all right, this is who we got, LeBron. You know, we're going to get Paul George in here. We're going to get you in here. And we've got Lonzo Ball, and somehow that's going to be enough, which it's not. He's not going to go to the Lakers. The Lakers are terrible.
Yeah,
there's no way that's going to happen. The Lakers are not anywhere near close enough to lure LeBron. It just isn't going to happen. I know, you know, someone's going to try and talk that into reality, but it would be just such a terrible move for LeBron if it happened too, because now he has to go through the Warriors just to get to the finals, which is going to be not going to happen. So it's a far worse scenario for him.
Right, but it does kind of bring up, highlight a point. I mean, are Bulls better off taking on salary now, or are they right before the trade deadline, or are they better off, you know, keeping their powder keg dry and holding off until before free agency? Is that, do you think they're more likely to get a better deal now coming up, or a better deal then? It's kind of hard to predict what kind of those deals are going to be available right before free agency, and so that's it's a really tough situation, because you could take on salary now, Doug, right, and just remove yourself from that situation, a potential real home run deal right before free agency starts.
Well, there's a few things to consider. One, I don't think there's very many teams at all who can take on salary now. So now the Bulls might have considerable leverage in terms of if someone wants to make a deal and they need the Bulls to play facilitator. Mm-hmm. In the offseason, there's not a ton of teams with like max cap space, but there's a lot of teams with some cap space, and a lot of those teams aren't going to really want free agents. So there's going to be a lot of teams who are maybe willing to facilitate in the summer. So now you're going to be able to have to compete against a lot more teams. It also just depends who's trying to make a move. I mean, it could be the case at the deadline. No one wants to free up salary at the deadline right now. So there's no opportunity to do anything now. So the way I would look at it is, if you have a good opportunity now, you should take it. Because I think the odds of you having a great opportunity in the summer probably aren't so good. But if you have a good opportunity now, you should take it. If you don't have a good opportunity now, then yeah, you might have a good one in the summer, and you should take it if it happens then too.
And you're, just to review, you're not on the camp of trading Nico for a second round pick, Lopez for a second round pick. I don't think so.
Yeah. No, not anymore. I think at this point, I'm like, if you can't get a first rounder, I say you keep Nico, and you just see where this team goes. Even keep him next year. Keep him on that team option, and watch how deadly this team can become. And then maybe if he continues to play at this high level for a season and a half, maybe you can't really trade him because he's an expiring guy and no one wants to bid, and maybe he leaves, or maybe he stays, or maybe you figure out, he actually played this well for a year and a half, let's get rid of Bobby Portis and we'll pay the man, and then it'll be Lowry and Nico playing together. That would be a pretty deadly combination. I don't think it's likely that there's a scenario where Nico stays on the Bulls long term, but I think they're good enough now where I don't think the Bulls are going to go all in on tanking. I do think that would still be a viable option. If you just said, look, I'm going to trade Lopez, I'm going to trade Nico, I'm going to trade Nwaba, and I'm going to trade Holiday, I'm going to maybe trade all of these guys to the Cavs for basically that Brooklyn pick and another future Cleveland first round pick, and then just complete crap coming back. If you did something like that, and you said, look, you guys are getting killed, you need to make a move, this gives you like a ton of talent, to really compete with, something like that. And I guess maybe they don't need Lopez because they have enough big men, but, they give them the depth and everything they need to really do something. If you do that and Cleveland is willing to do something like that, then I'm okay with that type of move. And I think you can get now back down to where you're borderline top five or six, because you can't trade away like four of your rotation players and maintain this level of play, regardless of how good Levine and Lowry and Dunn would play. So I would be okay with that type of trade, but the Bulls really don't look like they're even considering something like that. So just trading Nico to me is probably not enough. I think Zach Levine is going to fill in that void, and he's still going to provide that scoring. And so trading Nico is not going to be enough. So I think now you need to get value back from him. You need to get a first rounder. And if you do that, then I think it's okay, because I don't think there's really a long-term fit for him here. But if you're only going to get back a second rounder, then I'd say, all right, he's probably not going to stay. But you might as well take the chance, because a second rounder probably isn't going to do anything for you anyway.
Yeah. I'm going to read you something really quick to that end before we wrap things up here. And this was from Howard Beck. He tweeted this morning in Jason Lloyd, overnight report from The Athletic, and he had two comments about the Cavs. Because to me, the team that there is a deal with that we could potentially extricate a high number one lottery pick is the Cavs with that Brooklyn pick. Quote, "This is the worst it has ever been. This cannot be overstated or exaggerated. The mood around the locker room," he's talking about the Cavs now, "the vibe among players, the general theme throughout the organization is a stunning bewilderment of how it all fell apart so quickly. Even LeBron James is privately acknowledging to those around him that this is the worst it has been since he returned," end quote. That's an organization that, if they're serious about keeping LeBron and they really want to challenge for a title this year, needs to make a major move. And I think that major move could be Holiday, Nico, Lopez to the Cavs for some type of return and that pick. And that would potentially, I think, stabilize the team, improve the team immensely, at least defensively, just the addition of Lopez. What say you, and do you think the Cavs would be willing to make that move?
I think the Cavs are probably at the point where they say, you know what, it's not going to work out. We're not going to keep LeBron. And they're just done.
Really?
I think they're just going to try and rebuild. That's what my gut feeling is that they just feel like they're probably at some point looking at LeBron's age curve going, like, how many good years do we really have with him? We don't have another way really to get a star next to him that we don't already have. We lost Kyrie Irving and that's really what happened, right? Like, I mean, everyone wants to, like, oh, well, things are so bad. We don't know why I fell apart. Well, it's obvious why I fell apart. You lost a superstar caliber player, and you got back a fake superstar. And I mean, that's why it fell apart. That's why it's not working. So, I mean, it's clear. They had a major talent loss. They have no way to get back another major talent with LeBron. And so if Cleveland is desperate enough to try and hang on to him, this is the type of move. I think you have to throw David Wabba in there too, just because he's a really solid player and his contract is super cheap. I think you also have to find a way where you're taking like salary back off of their hands. You're going to take on maybe some of their higher salary stuff and bring more salary back, save them some luxury tax money as well, which won't really cost us anything meaningful. And then maybe, but I don't think Cleveland is that desperate. I think Cleveland instead probably knows that this is the end of the line. That they're not realistically going to be able to compete for a title again, even if they can keep LeBron James. And so their best bet is to start bringing in, new talent and just let him go. If they have not realized that, they should realize that because that's absolutely what they should do. But I do agree, this is the type of team where if you're a Bulls and their management, you could say, look, we're going to trade you all of our good people here who aren't long-term fits for the team, and we'll take back absolutely no talent whatsoever. And we just want, and I say I want one of their picks too.